listening to Radio Orbit with Mike Hagan on KOPN 89.5 FM.
Yes, it's all true. You are listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN, and my name is Mike Hagan. Julia Watson is an academic and an author. She is the principal founder of Julia Watson Studio, an experiential landscape and urban design studio, as well as a director and co-founder of A Future Studio, a collective of conscious designers with an ethos toward global ecological change. Julia teaches urban design at the Harvard Graduate School of Design and at Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. She's written a wonderful new book called Low Tech, Design by Radical Indigenism. I had the pleasure of speaking with Julia about a week ago. We discussed, among other things, her new book. This is our conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let's first please start off with a little bit of background. Your history, as far back as you'd like to go, and perhaps some of the experience that, or experiences that led you to become interested in design and eventually indigenous land use and urban design.
Yeah, sure. I usually go back to when I was studying architecture, which is not, you know, the most obvious place to start when you're talking about indigenous cultural and sacred landscapes. But I was a second year architect, and I did this one subject that was called Aboriginal Environments, which it's in Australia, and that Aboriginal landscape is really prevalent when you're a designer. So I guess in that context, it wasn't that strange, but we had an incredible Aboriginal design unit at the university where I was studying, and I just did this subject, and it was like a veil kind of was lifted from in front of my eyes, and I just started to understand this idea of the indigenous relationship to land that I had no experience of before, had never really come across it, and just this really incredibly intelligent and spiritual understanding of landscapes and human relationships to nature that sort of completely changed my world and probably put me on this pathway. And then I, you know, cut forward. I was working for a couple of years, decided as a backpacker, as an Australian backpacker, to go over to London, as we all do, for a couple of years. and on the way, I went to Borneo.
Wow.
And there I was looking for a tribe that I had been interested in called the Penan people, who Wade Davis has spoken about, who's an amazing anthropologist.
Yes, he did the foreword to your book.
And and he did. That was really special, because I've actually been, you know, a huge follower of Wade for the last 20 years, since my early 20s when I went to Borneo. But I went looking for the Penan people, and I was also looking for wild orangutans, because I was really into nature and orangutans at the time.
That's a mountain landscape? Is that a mountain landscape or a forest?
It's forest. It's the Dipterocarp forest, a huge ancient forest in a place called the Sacred Heart of Borneo.
Wow.
It's sort of like an interesting side story. There was a Swiss environmentalist that was helping these indigenous community fight against the government so that they weren't removed from their forest, which was being converted into palm oil plantations. So they had been protesting, and he was helping lead these protests. He had written about them a lot, and he went missing, and it was later revealed that he was probably murdered in the jungle when he was traveling because he was assisting these people. And it was really shocked me that it was like, you know, this type of situation could occur to people who are just trying to protect the natural world. So it was kind of this moment where I was like, okay, I want to go and think about what this is about and in this relationship with indigenous people to nature. And and how we've sort of become so distant from that relationship. And that's kind of like the very beginning of the work. I worked as a traditional landscape architect for years in London and back in Sydney, and then I applied to Harvard to get really serious about studying what it is to conserve a sacred landscape. And that's kind of where it really kicked off. I got into Harvard and started studying there. It's very non-traditional, and it's kept on going from there.
Okay. Do you mind me asking what part of Australia you're from and where you were studying there?
Yeah, I'm from Brisbane, Queensland.
Huh.
So, yeah, northeast state, which is not super affected by the fires.
Uh-huh.
Right now, Brisbane is a little bit further north to where a lot of the fires have been happening in northern New South Wales and Victoria. And I studied at the University of Queensland, and the unit that I really, you know, had that really big epiphany, that moment, was it's the Aboriginal Environments Unit. It's run by Dr. Paul Memmott. He's like a world leader in the understanding of the relationships of Aboriginal people to the landscape, infrastructure, and housing.
Okay. You know, as a side note, I've been there. I've been to Brisbane, and it's beautiful. And I actually spent a lot of time in Bundaberg, which is not too far from there, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's where we get a Bundaberg ginger ale, ginger beer.
Yeah, and they make some rum there as well, I think.
Yeah, and the Bundy rum.
Well, anyway, it's a beautiful country, and I really enjoyed the time that I got to spend there, and I'm hoping to get back one of these days. You never know. So, okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So you have a new book that is being very well received out there in the world. It's called Low Tech, Designed by Radical Indigenism. So first question, why did you write the book? And then I'll get to what is radical indigenism?
Yeah. I wrote the book because people kept on telling me to write the book. I've been talking about this for 7 or 8 years, and every time I'd speak about this, people would come up and say, where can I find all this? Like, how do you know all these things that just seem probably pretty obscure, but incredibly interesting? And it's not work that's really part of the field of design or landscape architecture or urbanism. It's kind of at the periphery. Some people speak about nature-based technologies, but never as kind of a body of work that has yet to be explored. And I just got really fascinated, and I would say probably obsessed, with searching for these nature-based technologies and really trying to convince people that there was such a thing called a nature-based technology. And the more I got into it, and through all my... Since graduating from Harvard, I've been teaching for the last 12 years, both at Harvard and Columbia and RISD. And I just realized that on the cusp of like what everybody is talking about with designing cities, this is the most relevant and the most critical type of technology that we need to embed into our cities if we're going to actually have an impact upon climate change.
Okay. And radical indigenism, how would you describe that or define it?
It's actually not my term. It is a term from a professor. She's from the Cherokee Nation, Eva Marie Groot, and she came up with this term, radical indigenism, that I adopted for the book. And it actually means going back to the roots of knowledge and reformulating, you know, contemporary concepts based upon indigenous wisdom and indigenous thinking. So going back to the idea of sustainability and saying, well, what was at the root of sustainability? What's actually at the root of sustainability is it's a term that was borrowed from the Iroquois, from the Great Lore, and it means to make decisions in considering the next seven generations.
Yes.
And so kind of embedded in the whole concept that this book is about sustainability. It's about nature-based technologies that can help us with climate change. It really is like going back and really thinking, know, what is the knowledge that, that we've distanced ourselves from that can reformulate a completely different way that we interact with nature and sort of design in this world.
Yeah. You know, when you mentioned the term nature-based technology, the first thing that came to my mind was medicine. I've been interested in ethnopharmacology for a long time, and if people don't think there's nature-based technologies, well, the great majority of medicines that people use are plant-based compounds, and they came from nature first, most of them. So
it's funny because when people don't understand the term or the thinking behind these sort of nature-based technologies or infrastructures, the easiest way to translate it is to say, so we have medicine, like as a formal discipline, and then we have alternative therapies, or we have Chinese medicine, these kind of their own. Chinese medicine is probably the best example because it has like a lineage of thousands and thousands of years.
Right.
It just comes from like a different ideology, and I think that's kind of what this thinking is doing, in a sense. But it's doing it with technology and urbanism. So that's kind of like the easiest translation. It's like we're like the Chinese medicine of urbanism.
Okay. All right. Like we mentioned a little bit earlier, the foreword is written by world-renowned anthropologist, author, and explorer Wade Davis. How did that happen?
I have been emailing Wade over the years, since I don't know how long, just every once in a while telling him, you know, his work is incredible and how, you know, I've been writing this book and I was really inspired by his work. And he's always, you know, he's always replied and been really encouraging. And I reached out to him on a whim, because it's not a small feat to write an introduction for somebody else's book. So I thought, you know, I'll just give it a shot because this would be my dream if Wade were to introduce the book. And he was really excited. And he also gave he's an amazing photographer. He gave us photographs for his introduction. And it was really, I think it really allowed, I know for Tashin, for myself and probably for a lot of people who picked up the book, it sort of gave the topic a lot more gravity, and it was really incredible that he could lend his support, because I'm a first time author. He's published, I think, like 19 books.
It's crazy.
He's incredible. So I was here, and he was just, you know, a delight, and his introduction is just really heartfelt and it's beautifully eloquent. He's an amazing writer. I was very, very happy and proud to have him contribute to the book.
All right, that's wonderful. Yes, he did write a very, very lovely foreword to the book. And the photos, and I'll add that right now, the book is lovely, and I think we should probably give out the information on how people might be able to get a look at it and perhaps a copy of it. Tashin, you mentioned earlier, is the name of your publisher, if I'm correct. So perhaps you could give that out now, the website address or particular contact information that you might like to share.
So Tashin is the publisher. They're a German-based publisher, usually like photography, art, and design. This book is pretty revolutionary for them, I would say. And there you can go to www.tashin.com and you can find the book under Low Tech, but it's also available. It's available in many, many retail outlets. You can find it on all the big distributors and probably in your local bookstores as well.
And Amazon and all that, I imagine.
Amazon, Walmart, Target. everybody seems to be latching on and helping distribute it and get the word out there.
All right. Well, that's fantastic. And I will add that you have a personal website at juliawatson.com. And I'm not sure how directly related that is to the book. I know there's a little bit of information about the book there, but you also have been involved in all kinds of other things in your past, and there's a little bit of all of that there, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. All right, so in the foreword that Dr. Davis so kindly wrote, he draws attention to the striking differences in which modern cities are designed in comparison to older urban designs, such as native indigenous designs. Let's talk first a little bit about modern cities, and then we'll do some comparisons, okay?
Yeah.
Why don't you do that? Tell us the way cities are designed now.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously we're in a period of time where the biggest kind of questions are coming up because the way that cities are designed weren't designed in this era of climate change. They're actually designed in a previous time when we didn't understand perhaps the impact. We didn't have to deal with such extreme impacts of climate change. And I mean, cities are designed as a legacy of modernism and industrialization. So really all that thinking, which in the book I talk about, that sometimes that partly that type of thinking has got us to the moment we are now, what is like the basic building block and construction of our cities. You know, we have like cities that are built on the processes of extraction. Our whole modern cities are vehicles for this extraction from the landscape, whether it's fuel or resources or we've really come to this paradigm of sort of using nature for our benefit in a way that doesn't really give back. And so the book is really sort of one of the ways that I start to talk about the design of cities for the future is using biodiversity as a building block. And the nature-based technologies, they really do that in a way that we as designers haven't really considered as like a vehicle for design yet. So you would use like the energy of algae and fish and bacteria as a way to treat sewage water in a large aquaculture system that would then provide food for your city, mitigate carbon and clean water all at the same time. And that's kind of one of the examples is, our wastewater treatment systems in cities are very industrialized processes that can process raw sewage, huge capacities. But in the book, there is the wastewater treatment system for the city of Calcutta, which is a city of 15 million people in India. And the half of the wastewater from that city is treated in a huge aquaculture system that is a nature-based technology that doesn't need any energy. It doesn't have any industrial processes. It provides 60,000 jobs for local fishermen. It produces 16% of the fish for the city that's eaten every day. It grows agriculture. It cleans the water. And it sinks the carbon, it cleans the air, it has all these, it's like a huge bird habitat. It's just a huge natural system that has been adjusted so that it is processing all that sewage. And that type of nature-based technology we could use in our cities. There's no reason we can't. I mean, there's legislative reason, there's policy reason, there's a reason for, our thinking, but those types of technologies and infrastructure can be embedded in our contemporary cities and really shift completely how the way we design.
Yeah, cool. All right, so the title of your book again is called Low Tech, and the subtitle Designed by Radical Indigenism. There are a number of terms that perhaps we could discuss that you kind of go into in the low-tech lexicon. There are some that perhaps aren't necessary, but I think we should actually talk a little bit about the terminology. Could you maybe talk about some of the language?
Yeah. I actually go through a couple of these terms. So, we live in cities that are pretty high-tech, and our lifestyles are pretty high-tech, and high-tech is dealing with, these industrial technologies, I would say. So systems that are sort of considered really sophisticated, and they permeate our lives. Low tech is often considered on the opposite spectrum. They're usually considered like primitive, pretty basic technologies, usually kind of in design. They're dealt with in the developing world as means to assist like easy water collection or pumping of water or something like that. So that there's this comparison, and it's always seen that low tech is kind of like the lesser of high tech. You know, it's more basic, it's primitive. With the title of the book, Low Tech, but L-O-T-E-K, that comes from hybridizing that concept of low tech, but with another concept called TEK, or the big long term is traditional ecological knowledge. And that's the type of knowledge that is embedded within all these systems, but it's really just knowledge that's built up over thousands of years. It's cumulative knowledge that's passed down through generations about your environment, about the things that you can do to adapt your environment, about your understanding of the world, so often in mythology, and also the ways, the practices, the ways that you might work in your community to create those technologies or those relationships. And so, and it's really an incredibly sophisticated understanding of the natural world. And that's what these, that's kind of like, that's why we came up with it. I came up with the term low tech, to really reconceive of this idea that and actually a lot of these systems are sometimes mistakenly called low tech, T-E-C-H. They're thought of as primitive. But what I've been talking about is the fact that these are really incredibly sophisticated and innovative ways of adapting our ecosystems so that they are, we as humans, we can still interact with them. We can survive with them and from them. They can produce food for us, clean water for us, etc. But we're not disturbing them like we do in contemporary cities, and reducing the biodiversity or polluting. It's really the opposite. And we there's many examples in the book. We actually can, as designers and as humans, live with nature and make ecosystems more vibrant and more habitable for us as well as for multiple other species.
As a matter of fact, the designs of some of these indigenous conceptually they may seem primitive or simple, but oftentimes the more you learn about it, they're so effective and so clever and so absolutely efficient at getting done what you're trying to get done, whatever it might be.
And it's funny because we're getting to that point where we're talking about sustainability, and we think, okay, sustainable systems are low cost, they use local resources, they're not drawing lots of energy there. Our most sustainable technologies, thinking of photovoltaics, they're becoming cheaper, they're becoming easier to manufacture, they're using sunlight as an energy source, it's non-polluting. These systems already do that.
Why reinvent the wheel, right?
We need all the high tech that's really sustainable. And that I'm a huge, I taught technology. That's kind of other part of where the book came from. I was teaching technology, and I started to understand that a lot of our urban technologies, our green infrastructures, actually come from a different type of technology from the past. We've just kind of like packaged them as contemporary and new, and then we're like, oh, a green roof, yeah, that's very much a modern contemporary way of designing sustainably. But we've been the Nordic people have been doing that for thousands of years. So, it's this relationship between understanding that where we're heading with sustainability and technology is actually where we already are. So we just have to really open our eyes.
Yeah, and rediscover.
Yeah.
All right, a couple other ones I'd like to mention. Simultaneous innovation. I've always thought that that's a very interesting concept, and it comes into play a little bit in your book. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that was like a really interesting thing that came up as I kept on doing all the research. And it's a phenomenon that happens in the scientific world, and it's when, you'll get simultaneous innovations or scientific discoveries happening in very separate places, but exactly the same time.
And, yeah.
You know, some people talk about these things like, oh, it's coincidences, it's whatever. But this is actually what's happened all over the world with different Indigenous communities. So you'll find communities in Australia will use pyrotechnology as a way to farm, which is using fire. But once I started researching, I found that the Mayan used pyrotechnology, the Kayapo in the Amazon, the Chaga who are on the southern slopes of Kilimanjaro. So there's these practices that simultaneously evolve. And in a way, you have to question, like, does that just mean that that's the obvious solution and the most, the best solution? So why are we ignoring these things, which are best case scenario solutions that have simultaneously innovated around the world? There's an interesting example that I use that parallels to scientific discovery, and I talk about Darwin and Alfred Russel Wallace the book.
Yeah.
And so Darwin, and obviously we all know who Darwin is. He's the father of the theory of evolution. He talked about survival of the fittest. But he was simultaneously, as he was sort of talking about these ideas, there was another man who was over in Bali, in Indonesia, Alfred Russel Wallace, who was discovering the same thing, the theory of natural selection and evolution of species. He wrote to Darwin and said, I've got this amazing idea. And Darwin was like, there's a very famous story that Darwin was sort of taken aback and invited him to come and deliver a lecture. They kept on working on it sort of from across the globe. They finally delivered this lecture. A year later, Darwin published his book.
Wow.
And it's kind of it's a little bit of a contentious story in the history of scientific discovery, because Alfred Russel Wallace, simultaneously came up with these ideas, and they really sort of co-evolved these theories together. Darwin ended up being the person who was given all the acclaim, and Alfred Russel Wallace was eventually shunned by the scientific community because he was really, he was a spiritualist, and he would talk about science and spiritualism being interlinked and entwined, and that they couldn't be conceived of as separate things. But in that period of time, spiritualism and religion and science were not considered, and it was almost like blasphemous scientists to be discussing those in the same terms. And he ended up being shunned from the scientific community and never again really taken seriously. And it's really interesting because the book is actually about science and spiritualism.
right. All right. Well, let's talk about some of the examples of different cultures in different regions and what they do that's unique and how they might help us, or how we might adapt some of these techniques, concepts, etc., into what we consider, the modern world. And let's sort of follow the path of the book and start with the mountains.
Okay, yeah. So in the mountains section, I'm just thinking, what do we have there?
There's the Waru.
I could speak about any of them.
Let's talk about the Waru.
Okay, yeah, the Waru were. So this is it's a means by which people at really high altitudes have figured out how to farm in soils that might be hit by frost or might be hit by drought. And they've created these like micro topographies of a channel and a raised mound. And you also find this in many communities across the world. This is just the example that's shown in the book. And what happens is it's just like these raised beds that are surrounded by water, in which people grow food and often fish as well. What happens is that in these high altitudes, often in the morning, there'll be a frost, and usually you'll lose your plant species with a frost.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology in this system is that during the day, sunlight will hit the water in the canals that's right next to these raised beds, and it will absorb all that heat. And in the nighttime, that heat will actually, through sort of like a osmotic process, it will sink into the ground so that when the frost hits in the morning, the ground is still really warm and those plants, the roots of those plants are protected, and so that these crops can have these really amazing life cycles, and you're not ever going to have this condition of food shortage. So,
wow, cool.
Yeah.
All right. We've also talked quite a bit in the book about rice terraces.
Right. Yes. Yes. But yeah, the Balinese, that's the best example.
Yeah, maybe you could talk about that a little bit. And then for the last one, with regard to the mountain landscape, I'm really interested in the root bridges that... I can't pronounce the name, I don't think. I'm going to let you do that, but...
Okay. I probably can't... I don't know if I pronounce the name either. But the Subak... I actually had the fortune to work with the Subak. I was the designer for the tourism and conservation plan for Bali's first UNESCO World Heritage Site, which was actually conserving 16,000 hectares of these rice terraces, which are
wow.
sacred landscapes to the Balinese. But also they're one of the most biodiverse agriculture systems that we have on Earth. And it's really deeply related to the spirituality and the way that Balinese people understand the spiritual world and the cosmos of Bali. But these are rice terraces at really steep heights, and they're just, you know, the hills of Bali, the mountainous hills of Bali, are completely terraformed with these rice terraces. And they're not just terraces, there's actually underground tunnels. And that's a very specific job to be a tunneler. And they're taking water from higher sources, and they're going kilometers underground to like funnel water, and then for the water to pop out in a different subak. And the subak is like a big area of rice terraces where there's many farmers who are farming in that landscape. And the subak doesn't use pesticides or fertilizers. It has multiple crop cycles, multiple harvests in a year. And the reason they don't use any fertilizers is because their forests at the top of their mountains are protected because it's the most spiritual part of the island. And in the soil, the volcanic soil, because the forests are protected, when the rains come, the monsoon rains come, it actually takes all the minerals and nutrients and phosphates that are required, that are the fertilizers for these rice terraces, and it leaches them all through rainwater down into the rice terraces. So basically flushes and fertilizes twice a year with the wet and dry monsoon.
Amazing.
And then there's the condition of not using pesticides. There's always at the sort of the head or at the top or uphill from one of these big subak areas, there's a water temple. And there's a priest who's in charge of that water temple. And he will tell all the farmers down in that watershed when they should fill up all their rice terraces and when they should drain them. And they do it simultaneously on humongous scales. And the reason they do that is to starve pests of anything to eat. So they don't have, you know, rodents and insect infestations, because they actually flood and then drain at these incredible scales simultaneously, because the priests align all the way throughout the island and tell them when to do that. So it's this incredible relationship with the spirituality and the priests operating with the farmers to create this completely organic mass hydrological farming system that is just, it's really a beautiful landscape as well.
Wow, remarkable. Okay.
And the bridges.
Yeah, let's talk about the bridges, and then let's talk about how we might incorporate some of this stuff, okay?
Yeah. The bridges are definitely some of the most beautiful photographs in the book.
There's some beautiful photos in the book, by the way. Very well done. The book is really well done, and it has wonderful information, but also some beautiful photos, yeah.
Yeah. The photographs took nearly as long as the writing. I ended up sourcing photographs. Some of them are from, you know, some of the world's best known National Geographic photographers, but sometimes it's like a person, Tommy Liu, who I found on Flickr, who had a couple of photos on Flickr, who'd never had a photo published before,
right,
who I contacted, and he was so overjoyed to have his photograph.
Oh, I'm sure. What a thrill. What a thrill.
Yes, and it's been an amazing process of contacting people from all over the world to, you know, to get permissions and to be able to use their photos. And I mean, that was a really fun part of the process. But the living root bridges and ladders are they're designed by the Khasi, or constructed by the Khasi people, who are in very northern India in an area called Cherrapunji.
Okay.
And this area is, I think it's one of the highest rainfall areas in the world. And it's a kind of a pretty mountainous area. I've been there and photographed there. And it's, you know, beautiful forests and really steep ravines. I think there's like 8,000 stairs to get down to visit one of these bridges. Which,
wow.
It's as hard to walk down as it is to walk up that many stairs. But they design these bridges and create these bridges by grabbing these secondary aerial roots, so that the roots that hang down from the branches of a ficus tree.
Okay.
And the ficus trees are very, very big canopied trees that grow in this forest. And they grab those roots and they train them, like they kind of like scaffold them using the bark, the sort of outside bark of another tree called the betel tree,
mm-hmm.
the betel nut tree, and they scaffold these roots so that the roots actually grow across these rivers, and they bed down into the other side of the river, and eventually they'll train them. After 50 years, they've created a bridge, and there's some single-decker, there's some double-decker, they're doing a triple-decker bridge now.
Yeah, it's stunning.
And you can literally hug one of the bracing systems on these bridges and, you know, get your whole body around it. And, you know, it's so interesting to like tap something that we know is an inanimate object and to hear like the echo and realize that it's a living thing.
Mm, yeah.
But it's still a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so they actually started creating these bridges because when the monsoon rains come through here, because there's so much rainfall, they just knock out every single bridge. And these are the only bridges that actually have proven to withstand the incredible force of the monsoonal rivers and the rains that come through. Mm. And so,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so they're really sustainable.
Wow, amazing. All right. So, for example, with the bridges as such and with some of the terracing, how could we perhaps learn from these designs and somehow incorporate them into what we might be doing?
Yeah. There's other people besides me who are doing sort of like deeper investigations into some of these specific technologies. There's a researcher in Germany who I'm in contact with who has really studied these living root bridges. I actually just came in contact with him about 6 months ago. We didn't know we were doing the same type of work. That's a simultaneous innovation thing going on. But he's found hundreds of these bridges. I had previously said that there are a handful. That's what I came across in the documentation. He's literally found like over 300 of them.
Wow.
And yeah, and you know, he's also a landscape architect and an urbanist. And I've sort of used schematically the idea of embedding these trees into cities and then growing bridges or into cities or growing a system so it's a structural system. So it could be that these trees are trained to grow as bridges, they're trained to grow as part of your bus shelters, that they're somehow embedded into the urban fabric and the structural system in our urban fabric, so that your canopy cover is also your like, you know, building material as well. So we're not designing always these sort of dead infrastructure nesties, that we can use our living materials as trees, and we can really sort of design structural systems that are part of our tree systems.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I think for the rice terrace is the easiest application that we've been talking about and designing. Is building that type of agricultural water irrigation system and sort of bringing that into skyscrapers, and not just stopping at the application of plants and trees into the facades of buildings, but actually going that step further and saying, okay, why can't our green systems become part of our facade systems, our skyscrapers? Because the scale is similar in the Philippines. The Ifugao people, they're terracing at like 80% slopes, which is nearly vertical. And they figured out how to do this. And we have the technology, we have the building material, we have the construction techniques. It wouldn't be, we just are not in the mind frame of really thinking, okay, how do we bring agriculture into cities and not just have it be on the roof? Right. How do we actually bring it into our vertical system?
Very interesting. Okay, so let's continue though. We also have some other different landscapes that I'd like to at least touch on. The mountains and the forests are a little bit similar, but definitely different in many ways. And then we also have deserts and wetlands. Let's talk a little bit about each of these if we can, all right?
Yeah, sure. I mean,
the one that I'd like to ask about in particular is this the underground aqueducts. I think that's fascinating.
That's a really good example, because the Kanat are these sort of underground tunnels that that tap an underground aquifer, which is an underground body of water. Usually that's where we get our drinking water from, the aquifers that are deep in the earth. Mm-hmm. We pump the water out. But these systems actually are horizontally built underneath the earth, and they tap an aquifer system, and then through that tunnel, slowly sloping, eventually the water will come out of a mountainside, and they use that water to feed cities. They use it for a lot of things. There's the effect of water, bringing water to cities in really arid environments and desert landscapes, because part of the problem with transferring water in a really desert landscape is evaporation. So if you've got water exposed to the surface of the earth, it's going to disappear. But because it's underground and it's tapping the aquifer as well, it's staying cool. It's also sustainable, because once the aquifer drops, if it's tapped too much, then your canal will, the water will lower in that system. So you've got your checks and balances happening in real time. The city of Tehran was actually where the canals were first developed.
And this is in Iran, right?
Yes. Yeah, in Iran. And then that system in like the early, I think it was the 4th century, it actually traveled. So the Khanats were built, began in Tehran, they moved across the Middle East, the Romans used them, the Spanish have used them. We find them in the Canary Islands, China, even in the Americas we've found Khanats. So that particular technology, and it's still used today. It's kind of disappearing because obviously we have underground pipes, which are a colonial infrastructure. But that's a really sustainable example of an amazing system. The other thing that it does is it passively cools. So if you have a canal, often houses are built on top of these underground systems, and it'll passively cool your house as water moves down just through the sort of a ventilation system of hot to cool and pressure within the house.
Yeah.
They also use these canats. They'll have these ice houses, so they'll use the canats to create ice in the desert through a similar passive cooling.
Interesting. System. Cool. Yeah. Right on. Okay, so there's also another aqueduct, underground series of aqueducts that you studied in India. That was in, I think it's called Serengam. Could you maybe compare and contrast those from the one in the desert?
Yeah. So the Indian example, and that's why I show them, going back to that idea of this simultaneous innovation. Very, very different environments, like forest and desert. But the Serengam is a form of a canal because it is an underground water conveyor tunnel. And it's actually built into an area that has a really interesting rock called a laterite rock. And it's really, really hard rock, and you can't dig vertically. into it so well. So it's really hard to dig wells in that area. So what people did to adjust was they went horizontally. And that's the way these canals are designed, is they tap horizontally a mother well. So it was really kind of like out of the environmental conditions that, you know, the different type of soil conditions that this technology evolved. It's much smaller and usually not as greater distances. Like the canals in the Middle East are kilometers and kilometers long. But the ones in India are generally like shorter. They're in a more mountainous landscape and they end in a big pool. So they're usually used for irrigation for crops rather than sort of adapted to big urban scales.
Okay.
And yeah, they're usually sort of found in the desert. And they're also a technology that is, it's kind of being overshadowed by wells and pumping of aquifers. That is a real issue in India, because the pumping, obviously it's using energy and electricity, but it also, people pump aquifers without really understanding how low the aquifer is, or there's no regenerative process to recharge the aquifer. So there's a lot of issues with drinking water and aquifer depletion, which then leads to like fluoride contamination and all these other conditions. So the Sarangam is a really sustainable but also very environmentally friendly way of getting water for your agriculture.
Okay. Do you think that could be somehow adapted to help us out and make things a little bit more friendly?
I mean, we have terrible, issues in terms of aquifer depletion all over the world. And the design of cities that might use like these conveyors of water for future cities, probably not going to happen in a contemporary city, but design of future cities that actually have this relationship of checks and balances, and especially in arid environments, is applicable. And it's coming back. People are starting to restore some of these conditions. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest challenges for the Kanat is it takes a really long time to construct these underground systems. But we have, contemporary construction techniques now. So that condition, that limitation, can be dealt with in a different way in a contemporary context.
Yeah, there's a way to combine these modern technology perhaps with older technology and marry them in a way that's beneficial, All right, let's talk a little bit about the wetlands. I'm very interested in this as well. I know there are a number of examples that you put forward in the book, but the floating islands are interesting, and they also are perhaps another one of those examples of simultaneous development.
Innovation.
Yeah, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, in the world of resilience design, in responding to Sandy and Katrina, there's a lot going on with climate resilience and trying to think of how do we deal with sea level rise and storm surge and flooding. That seems to be sort of the greatest conversation that has been happening in the last 10 years, I would say. And so wetlands is really responding to a lot of that conversation and trying to open up our eyes to a lot more opportunities and possibilities for dealing with these types of conditions. And just to plug a little bit, the next book which we started writing is looking really specifically at, it's called Low Tech Underwater and Intertidal Technologies, because that condition of how metropolitan cities are going to deal with sea level rise is really critical to have at this moment. One way to do that, and there's multiple ways you can deal with that condition. You can fortify, so you can build walls or levees, but we know that they don't work. We've proven that.
Yeah.
And, every time there's a king tide now in Miami, people are flooded. Or we can float, we can raise. And that's been a technology that has been used for a really long time from the Netherlands, all over the world. Many, many cities are designed in that way. And one of the civilizations is featured in the book. There's the Euros and the Madan. And I'll start with the Euros. They are a community of about, 40 to 50 floating islands. They live on Lake Titicaca, which is in Peru. Mm-hmm. It's the highest navigable lake in the world, up at 3,850 meters above sea level. They're actually really near the Waru Waru.
The mountainous people that we talked about, yes.
Yeah. And they create, their whole community lives on floating islands that they make out of a reed that grows in their surrounds. Mm-hmm. It's called the Totora reed. And they actually don't just make their islands, they make their houses, they make their boats, they make their watchtowers, they eat Totora. So it's really funny because I always say that the Euros are actually like, they are Totora. They're constructed from like the molecular level of this reed all the way to their housing and to their islands. But they create these big floating islands. Multiple families live on them. And when you walk on them, I was there a couple of years ago, it's almost like walking on a mattress that's filled, a water mattress that's filled with water. It's really kind of a little bit awkward and spongy. But they create these huge, 6-foot by 3-foot bricks, and then they lash them all together, and then they cover, and these bricks float through a process of decomposition, multiple processes of decomposition, actually. They float, and they keep these, huge islands floating. The islands last for about 25 years, but they're constantly, maintained, and they're constantly updating and, putting straw down, putting the reed down and relaying the reed. But it's really, it's a really incredible process of construction. And interestingly, the Euros have this relationship also with seabirds that I found really interesting, is that the women actually rear the birds in their breasts from eggs. And then when the birds hatch, they have this really close relationship with the seabirds. And they watch the birds where they nest to see whether they're going to have floods that year. Because if the birds nest at water level, usually there's no flooding. So they'll know that they don't have to prepare for a big flood. Mm-hmm. If the birds nest higher up than water level, they know that there's going to be a big flood that year, lots of rain. So they're, they have this really interesting relationship with the birds. Yeah.
Wow. No, I mean, it's nature. The more attention you pay to it, the more you can learn. And you just have to be watching closely and paying attention. Absolutely fascinating, Julia. All right, I'm going to switch gears a little bit for a moment here and ask you about mythology. Mythology plays a large role in the book. And, and as a side note, I'm thinking about simultaneous innovation. In mythology, it's very similar. You find extremely similar concepts and ideas and stories throughout many different cultures that developed in different time periods and in geographically places that were, across the other side of the planet, perhaps. But anyway, mythology plays a large role in all of our lives, whether we think it does or not. Let's just have you talk about mythology in general, and then how you think that that applies to what we're talking about today.
Mythology, I think, from the time we're children, I was always really fascinated with mythology, especially Greek mythology, because I have Greek heritage. Mm-hmm. And it's these stories, especially when we're children, for some reason, that it kind of starts to teach you about the way that we conduct ourselves as a society, the good and bad, or, the really big tales about understanding the world, observation. Then, sort of, while they're stories, there's a lot of knowledge and social indicators and understandings embedded within these mythologies that I would say I was brought up on. Indigenous peoples have in their communities different mythologies, and the mythologies have often taken the place of like a written text, because often these communities don't have written text the way that they would remember or tell or relay information and stories is through these mythologies. And so embedded within the mythologies that are researched in the book, sometimes there's, the story of the three sisters, which is the corn, the beans, and the squash sister. And that is a story that you'll find the Mayans use when they're talking about the creation of the milpa system. And, there's the corn sister who grows really tall. There's the squash sister who grows around her and shades, and the bean sister that uses the corn sister to get up to sunlight. And it's really about that relationship of, and this, I'm talking now about the Zuni, the waffle gardens of the Zuni, where they plant beans, squash, and corn. And when you look into, what's really fascinating is when you look into like the molecular level of the combination of beans, squash, and corn, it actually gives you like all the lysines and all the nutrients in combination. If you were to remove one of those species, you wouldn't have a full diet. You would be quite deficient. But when you have the three combined, it gives you all the everything that you need for a healthy diet. And so, and that's about the mythology. All that knowledge and wisdom is embedded in that. And in every chapter, nearly every chapter, I've tried to research the mythology and how that relates to the technology. And then overarchingly, I kind of talk about this mythology of technology, which is really saying, you know, we are in a world today that, you know, had a legacy in with the Enlightenment and with knowledge and humanism and being passed down and technology as well, being a snapshot of a very small part of the world at that time. Usually, like, you know, we talk about the Enlightenment was part of Western, European, and mostly white part of the world. And that's how we kind of framed technology about 400 years ago. And you can see that that view is really still part of our framing of the understanding of technology. And I talk about the mythology of technology, that it has to be that way. Mm. And what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do with the book, is really rewrite that mythology, because mythology for Indigenous people is also living culture. And it's constantly, every time it's retold, it's changed a little bit by the teller. So it's actually like a living thing.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to say that we can actually have this, the current mythology of technology. It can be a living thing, both, you know, metaphorically, but also in reality, in terms of like actually using living materials as our technology.
I love it. Well, I'll tell you what, it's a beautiful book and extremely important information within it. Congratulations on its success. How about in conclusion here, let's talk a little bit about young people. And if you have any, I don't know if I'll use the word advice, but just thoughts or words for younger people who are coming up in a world that is quite a bit different than the one that I grew up in, and the potential and availability for opportunity and work that actually is meaningful and fulfilling.
Yeah.
Perhaps you could say something to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously there's a whole movement that's happening around the world with the global climate strikes, where young people are really, I think, feeling quite burdened with the weight of climate change and the effects that's going to happen in their lifetime. And the book is really trying to show us that there are many other ways that we can live in this world. And it's sort of, I talk about, you know, when one of the things that I remember most vividly from my childhood was when this natural disaster happened called the Exxon Valdez. You probably remember it.
Sure.
It was like the biggest oil spill that had ever happened.
Yeah, off the coast of Alaska.
At the time, happened in northern. Yeah, it was devastating. I remember sitting there as a kid watching the television, just watching all these animals, pulling these animals out of the bay that the spill happened in, covered in oil, and they were washing the animals. They lost hundreds of killer whales, thousands and thousands of birds.
Oh, I know.
And then I'm sitting here today, like, watching technology to prevent fires. It's called pyrotechnology or fire stick farming. The Aboriginal Australian people have been doing it for thousands and thousands of years. And what's happening now in Australia is that the lands that have used fire stick farming, the fires are going around those lands and they're fine. So it's sort of on us now to take that, these ideas and these concepts, to take this idea of technology, and it's on people who are actually going to be the most impacted by climate change, to push this vision forward, that we have to reframe the way human beings live with nature. And it has to be not about the survival of the fittest anymore. Like, that type of thinking that's old type of thinking. We're entering a new phase, and you know, we have to come up with new ideas. And I talked about this idea of survival of the most symbiotic. So
yes,
working
symbiosis,
together with other
yes.
species.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it's going to be, because we know now that human survival is dependent upon nature. It can't be that we're superior. We have to be symbiotic. And I feel like that's going to be the charge of the next generation to figure this out.
Well, and constructing a new mythology is part of that, and I think it's a beautiful way to conclude your book. So, well, very good. I have a note here. Are they making a film of some sort out of your book?
There are discussions about a film related to, or a documentary related to the book.
Mm-hmm.
There have been a couple of short videos that have happened so far, but nothing to announce at this point
okay.
in time, but I am going to be speaking at this year. The TED conference is called Uncharted, and it's gathering together all the climate scientists and leaders in their field to just talk about climate change. And so I will be speaking at TED this year, which would be an amazing forum.
Very good. I love it. I also think that it's wonderful that your book addresses some of the opportunity to deal with a newer type of environment. I love to think that we can actually, as a species, come together and somehow mitigate the changes in climate that we see are happening. But I also am sort of a realist, and I think that many of these things are going to happen, and we're going to have to come up with ways to live with them. And your book addresses that in many different ways. So I sure appreciate the work that you've done, Julia.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Very good. Okay, well, my guest has been Miss Julia Watson, on the web at juliawatson.com. Her new book is called Low Tech, Designed by Radical Indigenism. I'm thrilled to have had the chance to talk with you, and perhaps we can do it again when your new book is ready.
Yep, that'd be wonderful. Thanks so much.
All right, Julia, you take care of yourself.
Okay, bye.
All right, there you go. Julia Watson, on the web at juliawatson.com. Wonderful book called Low Tech, Designed by Radical Indigenism. Once again, Julia Watson on the web at juliawatson.com. You can find her on Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff as well, okay? All right, it's Mike, and you're listening to Radio Orbit on KOPN Columbia, 89.5 FM.